first opened, they filled the largest platters they could find. Not much has changed. Their legacy of huge portions continues today, and they've just introduced new diner deals. 6 new dinner combos and new home-style side choices. Baby back ribs and tri-tip, chicken strips and tri-tip, chicken Alfredo, chicken and pesto, ribs and shrimp, and cod and shrimp. There is always plenty for your paws at Black Bear Diner at 2605 Hilltop Drive or order online at blackbeardiner.com.
Black Bear Diner.
What's being hidden from us about the COVID-19 scenario, about covert climate engineering operations that are wreaking havoc with weather all over the world, about the totality of unfolding and accelerating global environmental collapse. If you're willing to face and investigate shocking, verifiable realities that mainstream media sources and their distract and divide talking heads will never tell you, tune into the commercial-free, non-political Global Alert News Hour, Saturday at 11 a.m. on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
Because of that geographic bias, this media that's so detached from the rest of the public, you get a fundamental distrust and you get a general disdain and smugness for the rest of the country when it doesn't operate the way that you think it should.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Steve Krakauer, media critic and former CNN executive. His new book is Uncovered, shining a spotlight on problems inside our media today. We'll talk in depth with Steve about that new book coming up in just a little bit. First, we're joined by Dr. Paul Marino. He is William and Bernice Grucock Chair in Constitutional History, Professor of History, and Dean of Social Sciences here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Marino, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
It is, and I'm sure all our listeners already know this, the 220th anniversary of the Marbury v. Madison decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. So we thought we'd go back, tell people about it, and the impact and the legacy that it has had in the country. So tell us quickly, what is the Marbury v. Madison case? Who's Marbury? Who's Madison? What issue is at stake?
Usually it's depicted as the first exercise of judicial review, the first time the Supreme Court strikes down an act of Congress. William Marbury was an officer who was appointed to an office in the last days, really the last minutes of the Adams administration. The Federalists had just lost the election of 1800, and so they created a bunch of new offices so they could reward their political supporters when they were on their way out. This office was the Justice of the Peace for the District of Columbia. And the outgoing president, John Adams, signed the commission for William Marbury and sealed it, but it wasn't delivered to him. The outgoing Secretary of State happens to be John Marshall. Mm-hmm. He was at the time holding the offices both of Secretary of State and Chief Justice of the United States. So he left the commission sort of on his desk. The incoming administration is James Madison, his successor as Secretary of State. And Thomas Jefferson said, don't deliver this commission. You know, he's not getting the job. And Marbury brought suit to have that commission delivered, claiming that he had a right to the office. So that was what the case was about. It was involved in this, you know, dramatic and really unprecedented transfer of power from one party to another.
So you mentioned judicial review. What's the principle of judicial review? Why does it take a court case, this court case, to establish it, and why was it not simply written into the Constitution?
Yeah, that doesn't appear in so many words in the Constitution, but Alexander Hamilton explained this, you know, famously in Federalist 78, saying that if the Constitution is what it says it is, which is a higher law that establishes limits on the government, then if the government does something that violates the Constitution, judges have an obligation to prefer the higher law to the ordinary law. But the most important thing is it's not just the court that has that obligation. It's also Congress and the mm-hmm. president and even to some degree state actors and ultimately the people have to defend the supremacy of the Constitution.
Were there any rumors or whispers of judicial review before 1903? You've got about 15 years or so where perhaps it could have come up in front of the Supreme Court, or is this really the first time the issue is going to be in front of the court?
Yeah, sometimes the argument goes back to, I think, 1610, an English case called Dr. Bonham's case, where Edward Coke appears to have held an act of Parliament to be contrary to natural justice, to right reason. There's a lot of controversy about what exactly was going on in that case, but there were some subsequent cases in English history that used Dr. Bonham's case as a precedent. And there were state cases before 1803 that did this as well. So it seems pretty clear now that judicial review was expected. It was mm-hmm. just sort of part of the ordinary sort of course of judicial affairs. And even the U.S. Supreme Court heard cases that challenged acts of Congress. And it upheld the acts of Congress, but presumably it could have gone the other way, and that would have been the initial case of judicial review. There's one case, too, where the judges of the Supreme Court, by an act of Congress, were made to sort of adjudicate the claims of Revolutionary War veterans mm-hmm. about whether they were entitled to disability payments. The court refused to do that. They said that this is not a judicial office, and we are limited to the judicial powers. And that was before Marbury, so yeah, that was kind of an exercise of judicial review.
Tell us a little about Chief Justice Marshall, his involvement in the case, and why he becomes a central figure here.
He's really the man who made the Supreme Court and sort of saved it from the court before Marshall really had very little to do. The first Chief Justice, John Jay, resigned the office for the more important office of Governor of New York. And John Adams asked him to come back and resume the office of Chief Justice. And he said, no, this office is just too insignificant. I got been more important things to do. And Marshall was able to sort of rescue it and turn it into an equal, coordinate branch of the government. He was a great personality. Marshall was just sort of ideal for the sort of small group dynamics of an institution like the Supreme Court. He's also very fortunate to be so long-lived. He was about mm-hmm. the last of the founders, especially Madison outlived him, but Marshall was the last to still be in office. Passed away in 1835. And I often ask my students, can you name any Supreme Court justice who served with John Marshall? And they can't. And I say, you shouldn't be able to, because Marshall sort of overshadowed them, made them speak with one voice, and that voice was him. His. Almost every Marshall Court decision was unanimous, and Marshall wrote it.
Talking with Dr. Paul Marino about the Marbury v. Madison case 220 years ago, February 24th, 1803, the decision was handed down. What effect does this ruling have for the future of the court and for the future of the country?
Yeah, the short answer and the real historical answer is none. it's Marbury has been the source of a great deal of mythology. It wasn't for another 100 years that people started paying any attention to it. It was never cited as a precedent, except in some really minor technical cases that had to do with a specific writ that was at issue in the case. In the 1890s, though, a sort of conservative corporate lawyers and the bar began to sort of encourage the court to look upon Marbury as this license to engage in what comes to be called judicial activism.
Mm-hmm.
And then law schools took this, and now Marbury is considered the sort of the foundation and the cornerstone of the kind of extraordinary power that courts have in America. But that was far, far from what was going on in 1803.
Take us through a little deeper there in terms of how it changes past the 1890s, because I believe for the first 40, 50 years, there wasn't another instance even of judicial review until the 1850s.
Right. Dred Scott would be the second case in which the court overturns an act of Congress, and then that didn't go well. But it's interesting that the court didn't cite Marbury as a precedent when it struck down the Missouri Compromise, which had already been repealed anyway. So that was kind of an aberration. And Marbury didn't acquire any sort of publicity until the 1890s. So the court didn't strike down acts of Congress very frequently. In the 19th century, the important thing was keeping the states under control.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a great deal of judicial review of state legislation. But that was a lot less controversial than when the court tries to strike down an act of the coordinate branches, either the Congress or the president.
So was a ruling like this, like Marbury v. Madison, essentially inevitable
mm-hmm.
With the structure of checks and balances? Was this going to happen at some point?
Not necessarily, because Marshall really went out of his way to make Marbury a case. He could have decided the case differently on a number of grounds. Marshall, historians have wondered about what exactly Marshall thought he was doing here. He seems to be engaged in a very clever sort of cat and mouse game with Thomas Jefferson. They were second cousins. They didn't get along with each other, and Jefferson was going to be stuck with John Marshall as Chief Justice for beyond his lifetime. And what Marshall seems to be doing is telling Jefferson and Madison, you've broken the law. William Marbury has, a right to this, this office, and you're violating his rights. But there's nothing I can do about it. He sort of said, on jurisdictional grounds, this court doesn't have the power to issue this writ. And so he kind of lectured Jefferson and Madison about the rule of law and, you have to do your duty. But, he avoided the confrontation of having to issue an order in the case that Madison and Jefferson would have ignored.
Dr. Paul Marino, William and Bernice Grucock, Chair in Constitutional History, Professor of History, Dean of Social Sciences here at Hillsdale College as we talk about Marbury v. Madison 220 years ago. Dr. Marino, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Always a pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Up next, we talk with Steve Krakauer. His new book, Uncovered, How the Media Got Cozy with Power, Abandoned Its Principles, and Lost the People. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
In 1788, as the Constitution was being debated, James Madison wrote that the chief restraint preventing Congress from passing laws that apply to the people, but not to Congress, is the vigilant and manly spirit which actuates the people of America, a spirit which nourishes freedom. If this spirit shall ever diminish so as to tolerate a law not obligatory on the legislature, the people will be prepared to tolerate anything but liberty. Today, we Americans live under many laws that do not apply to elected officials and those who work for them. If we hope to preserve liberty, we must recultivate the freedom-loving spirit of our founding fathers. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
For more information, visit Hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Chandler, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arnn, on the continuing relevance of the Constitution.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century so long ago. And some of it does read sort of quaintly. But consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9, for example. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges for partisan reasons. This strikes at the rule of law, the rule under which we're all to be treated the same. The crony capitalism so common today, where the government gives favors and tax dollars to some businesses and advantages over others, is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. The Constitution is not outdated at all.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. Go to ConstitutionMinute.com.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century. Some parts of the Constitution do read rather quaintly, but consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges to some for partisan reasons. This strikes at the heart of the rule of law. The crony capitalism so common today is a place where the government bestows favors and tax dollars on some businesses to give them a leg up over others. This is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. Perhaps the Constitution is not so outdated after all. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
The word education comes from a Latin word that means to lead forth. Forth is a value-laden term. It raises a question. Which way is forth? How do you know you're going in the right direction? The easy answer in our time is it just depends on which way you want to go. Young people almost always say that today. They've been taught to say that. But that's the wrong answer.
At Hillsdale College, we understand education to be the pursuit of the highest answer to that question. Discovering the right way by reading the greatest books by the greatest minds in history. Coming to see the meaning of three ultimate and related things: the good, the true, and the beautiful. This is the way forth. This is education.
Learn more at hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu, click the subscribe button, enter your email address, and you'll get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Steve Krakauer. He's a journalist and media critic. He has worked all over the place: CNN, Fox News, NBC, The Blaze. Currently executive producer of The Megyn Kelly Show, also authors the Fourth Watch Media Newsletter, and he has a brand new book out, Uncovered: How the Media Got Cozy with Power, Abandoned Its Principles, and Lost the People. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Scott. Thanks so much for having me.
The book begins, Steve, with a chapter on the laptop, and we all know the laptop that we're talking about. And you say that this, you talk about this elite censorship collusion racket between big tech, big government, and the national media. We'll talk more about this through the interview, but briefly, how do you see those pieces coming together in this racket?
Yeah, I started the book, as you mentioned, with the Hunter Biden laptop story, because I do think that it felt like the sort of culmination of so many of the problems of the Trump era. Let's say the last, you know, the 2017, even maybe 2015, 2016, up through 2020. But it really portended even something more sinister, I think, and actually something that's gotten worse since Trump left office. And the racket that I mentioned is this idea that you've got government forces, you've got you know, government outlets that want what they want. You know, no matter what party it is, or whether it's intel agencies, they have a goal in mind, and those places are working essentially with the tech companies. You know, we've seen now since I published the book, or since I wrote the book, that through the Twitter files, the real conversations that were happening for years between government forces and tech platforms, and so you have that collusion that's happening. But the third layer of this is the media, the national sort of corporate press that's working together with these two entities as well. And in this case, it takes the form in, once Twitter goes and censors the New York Post and makes it so, like, unprecedented action, makes it so that link can't even be shared on social media, on Twitter. It can't be shared in direct messages, locks the New York Post out of its account for weeks. Instead of jumping to the New York Post's defense, instead, the media essentially is covering for that action. Years later, the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, other outlets actually got around to reporting on the laptop, making it very clear that it was a legitimate story from the beginning. Absolutely true. But during that moment, and for lots of reasons, you know, obviously the timing was a big factor here, that racket took place and it involved the media. And that actually is something that's even more damaging, I think, than the coverage that happened during the Trump era. This pretended this idea of anti-speech activism from the press, where we have to sort of tamp down on opinions getting out there, on potential news, the counter-consensus narrative, because we don't really trust the audience. We don't trust the public with it. We have to make sure that they don't see it, because they might make wrong decisions based on it. And that's really damaging for an industry that should care about the First Amendment, that should care about the freedom of speech. They're actually going the other direction.
It's important to note, I think, in Uncovered, Steve Krakauer's new book, there is not a lot of talk, and I don't think any real explicit discussion, of political bias in the media. You say this idea of it being geographic bias is far more important than, say, a geographic bias in the media. What do you mean by this geographic bias? How does it influence coverage?
Yes, that's right. You know, I'm not an overly ideological person myself, and I think it's not any secret to say that a lot of the media, you know, for decades has leaned left, probably votes for Democrats far more often than it does for Republicans. That's not something new, but at the same time, something has fundamentally shifted. Something has gotten much worse. And we see that with every poll of the public, American public, about what they think of the media, particularly that independent line. I mean, that has just completely cratered mm-hmm. in trust of the media. So what happened here? And I do think that geographic bias is much more pervasive than a political bias, because what we're seeing now, what I call the Acela media, the media that's based largely in New York City and in D.C., and I say this as someone who for a long time was based in New York City before I moved to Dallas 9 years ago, there's a certain groupthink that develops that you don't even necessarily know. It's almost more subconscious, and it goes to who you interact with on a regular basis. And I also think that this is something that people that are not in New York and D.C. know fundamentally, is that people are complicated. You know, the kind of messy political opinions that people have don't neatly fit in a box that would maybe make them perfect for a pundit panel on cable news. Mm-hmm. And because of that geographic bias, this media that's so detached from the rest of the public, you get a fundamental distrust. You get stories that are missed, and you get a kind of general disdain and smugness for the rest of the country when it doesn't operate the way that you think it should from your newsroom in New York and D.C.
The media also seems concerned with what their audience will do with this information. You have a great line as you discuss the difference between Joe Rogan and his podcast with the media. Joe Rogan, you call an informational maximalist compared to most of the rest of the media as informational minimalists. When did the media decide that the less information, and in some cases the less truth, that the audience received, the better it would be?
Yes, yeah. It is a real divide, I think, between the more independent-minded media outlets out there, the people like Joe Rogan, I would say the Megyn Kelly Show, podcasts, Substack, and the corporate media, which still has tremendous power. And I think that it shifted in a couple ways. Trump was a big factor to this. You know, when they go and try to say, when that November 2016 comes, and there's, as it's been reported, crying in the newsroom, this idea, this fundamental idea that this could not have happened. I don't know a single person who voted for Donald Trump, right? This is the thought in the newsroom. Something must have happened, and it must be something that we have to kind of tamp down on. I think it started there. And COVID, I would say, is another big turning point for this. This idea that we need collective action in a certain direction. And if we put things out there that are potentially untrue, you know, misinformation, that became a huge thing, mm-hmm. that might hurt me. That might hurt our country. As it turned out, it's just the opposite, right? The misinformation we got largely from the corporate press was turned out to not be true. So I think those are big factors here. And then I also think just the business model. You know, we have you know, journalism industry as a whole, that for a very long time, places like a CNN, places like an ESPN on the sports side, their business model, you know, there might be ups and downs, but it wasn't really an existential threat to it. But every single day, with audiences shifting from one sort of way that they consume content to another, now they suddenly have a real feeling of panic. I mean, this quicksand beneath their feet. Mm-hmm. And it leads them to try to tamp down on essentially competition, which is everyone. And the idea of making sure that information does not get out there disseminated, unedited, unchecked by the quote unquote, you know, quote, like elite sources. That's really a problem. And I think that as more independent outlets get out there where people can find what they're looking for, the more they distrust the gatekeepers that make up our corporate press and continue to erode the trust that they had in those previous institutions.
That's Steve Krakauer. His new book is Uncovered. We'll return to talk more about problems inside the media and what Steve thinks could be potential solutions. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
Not one penny. This is how much funding Hillsdale College receives from the government. Not even indirectly in the form of student loans or grants. Not one penny. There are thousands of colleges and universities in the U.S. The vast majority receive around 30% of their revenue from government funding, loans, and grants. In other words, these schools are dependent on the government to stay in business. And they receive more than $150 billion per year from taxpayers to do so. In contrast, Hillsdale refuses all government funding. Why? The answer is simple. Money from the government comes with strings attached. Do's and don'ts, restrictions and mandates that, in small but significant ways, influence how a school operates and educates. But from the very beginning in 1844, Hillsdale has been committed to providing a world-class education that upholds America's founding principles and preserves the blessings of civil and religious liberty. Therefore, everything Hillsdale does, from the private loans, grants, and scholarships it provides to 97% of its students, to the completely free online courses it offers to millions across the country, depends on generous donors who recognize how much independence is worth. Not one penny safeguards the college's mission. Not one penny preserves the quality and integrity of a Hillsdale education. Not one penny ensures that Hillsdale can continue to be a beacon of independence for all of its students on campus and across America.
For more information about Hillsdale College, visit hillsdale.edu. That's hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Joy, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is President of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arn, on why the Constitution limits government.
James Madison writes in Federalist 51 that men are not angels. Their passions and self-interest often get the better of their reason and sense of justice. So we need government in order to protect our rights against those who would take them away. But for the same reason, Madison writes, government must be limited, because people in government have passions and interests too. Many Americans today forget this. Supposing that we can do away with constitutional limits on government, supposing that the unelected bureaucrats being put in charge of our health care, for example, will rule as if they are angels. If Madison was correct about human nature, this is foolish and dangerous.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to constitutionminute.com.
Learning is hard work. Hard work requires character. Learning begins in faith. It must move upward toward the highest thing, unseen at the beginning, God. And freedom is essential to learning. Its principles must be studied and defended. Learning, character, faith, and freedom. These are the inseparable purposes of Hillsdale College.
Learn more at hillsdale.edu.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We've been talking with Steve Krakauer. His new book is Uncovered, How the Media Got Cozy with Power, Abandoned Its Principles, and Lost the People. Steve, a chapter on the broken financial incentive structure for the media. You say giant news properties no longer care whether large portions of the country would ever consume their news. And you talk about this in Substack. Substack, by nature, is someone trying to appeal to fans, to get them to pay them for their writing in some way. And I worry that the media has essentially gone down the same path, meaning they're providing a fan service through their stories with what they think their subscribers want.
do you see this problem that both essentially the Substack model and the large model now both essentially are fan service for subscribers?
100%. Yeah, I think it's a problem on both ends. And I think on the larger media outlet, you know, in chapter 9, about the financial incentive structure, I talk about ESPN. In chapter 10, similarly, talk about the New York Times. But they're so reliant now on that subscription model, or at the very least, on holding on to their core audience, because they feel the broader audience slipping away, and rightfully so. And so because of that, yes, the decision making is all out of whack, and they start to make these sorts of bizarre and counterproductive non-bottom line decisions that are often driven by people that are, you know, at the lower levels in their own newsrooms or people on Twitter and getting these, you know, yelled at by those places. And so yes, when you're no longer trying to accrue a large audience, you focus more on the audience that matters most to you, the one that you feel is your core, and that leads to really bad decision making, and it leads to even more sort of polarity on either side. And then to your point about Substack, I agree. I mean, I think that there's lots of value to Substack, but I also think that we need strong institutions on the journalism side as well. I've talked to people on Substack who say, you know, it's good to get the news out there, but when you do really strong reporting, you need a great legal department. Mm-hmm. You need resources. You need the backing of organizations, and that's sort of historically what journalism institutions provide. But we need both.
Tons of on-the-record interviews and quotes in this book from Ben Smith and Tucker Carlson, Bob Lee from ESPN. I read that ESPN chapter, which is great, and I come away and just think that place is a mess. And then I think and say, well, the New York Times newsroom is kind of a mess, and so is the Post and CNN in a way, and all these places. People can see what happens when you let, as you write, the kids run the newsroom. So why do they continue to do it? What is the benefit? Is it merely to pacify these Twitter scolds out there?
I think there's a lot of that for sure. I in chapter 11, I get into sort of Twitter and what that's done. And Twitter has some positives. And I have to say, I'm someone who probably spends more time on Twitter than I should. But I think what it does is, I'm not sure the heads of these organizations like the ESPNs and the CNNs and New York Times that you mentioned really fully understand just how damaging it is to their entire brand, where you have some good journalism coming out of these institutions, like the New York Times. Every day, there's some good pieces or a good podcast. But every single day, that good journalism is undermined by their own employees who are speaking freely on Twitter, who are letting their opinions out there, even individuals who do good journalism then go on Twitter and undermine it themselves. And they're not just hurting themselves, the individual journalists. They are an association with the brand and hurting the entire brand. So yes, I think it's very hard, like the cat's out of the bag at this point. It's going to be very hard to now tell your employees in these giant newsrooms, no, you have to get off Twitter. I know that there are lots of newsroom leaders who would like to do that and who have tried versions of it. But I actually kind of get into something at the end of the book, is that I've seen the rise of unions at these newsrooms. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if maybe that's a different avenue, because people are going to start losing their jobs even more frequently when they embarrass themselves and their organizations on Twitter. You want to keep a newsroom and to keep the jobs flowing, especially in a market like it is now. You need your colleagues to say, hey, listen, like, be careful with what you're doing out there. And you don't need to do that. That's not part of your job. I hope we get that, because, again, every single day it's happening and it's getting worse.
Steve, we've got just a couple of minutes left. I want to make sure I ask at least two more questions, because as you get to the end of the book, you do have some ideas for potential ways to maybe not solve the problem, but get better in the media. You talk about having organizations embed reporters in various communities across the country. And as you say, you don't even have to go outside of the state of New York. Go to Buffalo if you want. I thought I remember perhaps CNN attempting this just after 2016. And I don't know if it has dropped it or what. One of the issues is These organizations simply don't seem to care about stories if it is not D.C.-centric, if it does not involve the president, if it does not involve Donald Trump, if it is not about the House or the Senate. And if they do cover stories from outside of D.C., it's about how it might impact the next cycle with Ron DeSantis or other candidates who might run for Senate or House. It is so focused on D.C. that we miss all these stories across the country. How does that mindset change, even if you have reporters across the country?
Yeah, it is something that just seems right in the wheelhouse of a CNN or of these more legacy media outlets like an ABC News, NBC News, CBS News, to go and get into the communities and embed yourself there. Look, every single day we see stories that are really interesting. I'm just thinking of these train derailments that
right.
have become a major national stories now, but it took weeks to get it to the point where it became a national news. If you had people in these communities, you would understand the sorts of not politics, but policy that matters to these people. And you would find, like I talked about, the kind of more complicated points of view that are out there and what sort of it matters to these people, you know, family, faith. That I think is something that there is room for at these giant media organizations. And I think it's going to take a mindset shift in understanding that there is a whole business model, frankly. I mean, there's a financial incentive to do this. There's a need that is not being met by these large organizations to do this. And I do think it takes embedding reporters there. I mean, we see reporters kind of helicopter in during election cycles. They all go to Iowa. They talk to a few people in a diner and then they head back to New York or D.C. No, you need people there.
I want to ask one more question for Steve Krakauer. His new book, Uncovered, How the Media Got Cozy with Power, Abandoned Its Principles, and Lost the People. I've had this idea, and I think it somewhat addresses your description of the glance journalism that happens in the media, and that is to have someone dedicated at these outlets to simply doing follow-up journalism, meaning we told you this 3 weeks ago, now here's what's happening. We told you this 3 weeks ago, here's what we got wrong. We told you this 3 weeks ago, here are new details. They go back to the pandemic. We had this ventilator crisis, and then we didn't. It dropped. We talked about those days when oil was selling for negative dollars. What was the consequence of that? Even more recently, you mentioned the train derailments, Southwest Airlines meltdown over the holidays. We never seemed to find out more about these stories after that first 2 to 3 day rush. What about my idea, Steve, about dedicated follow-up journalists at outlets across the country?
I love it. I love it. Now, the news cycle, you know, the cable news cycle used to be called like the 24-hour news cycle. And now with Twitter, I mean, it really is like a 30-minute news cycle, frankly. You see things move so fast and it, everyone just scurries on to the next thing. And yes, I think that if you had your follow-up journalism, it would not get nearly as much attention as the original story did, but it will get some and it will reach people in a way that is necessary, because so many times this, like you mentioned, glance journalism, it becomes embedded in people's minds because it never gets a follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
People just learn one thing. This happens so often with mass shootings, sadly,
yeah.
where all of a sudden a point of view or a narrative about what happened congeals, and then it within days, and then it's gone, and then we never hear from it again, and a lot of times it's wrong.
Steve Krakauer, he is the executive producer of the Megyn Kelly Show, well worth seeking out his fourth Watch Media newsletter and the new book, Uncovered, How the Media Got Cozy with Power, Abandoned Its Principles, and Lost the People. Steve, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Scott, thanks so much for having me.
Up next, Hillsdale student Lauren Scott tells us about a student-produced documentary about one of Hillsdale's most famous alums, Elizabeth Smith Friedman. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
Many argue today that the Constitution is outdated because it addresses problems peculiar to the 18th century. Some parts of the Constitution do read rather quaintly. But consider the injunction against titles of nobility in Article 1, Section 9 of the Constitution. Is that so outdated? The purpose of that injunction is to prevent the government granting special privileges to some for partisan reasons. This strikes at the heart of the rule of law. The crony capitalism so common today is a place where the government bestows favors and tax dollars on some businesses to give them a leg up over others. This is exactly the kind of thing the Constitution was meant to prohibit. Perhaps the Constitution is not so outdated after all. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
Hi, I'm Devin, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is president of Hillsdale College, Dr. Larry Arndt, on what the founders meant by general welfare.
The great preamble of our Constitution states that the purpose of the document is in part to promote the general welfare. Contrary to the modern understanding of that term, the founders understood welfare to mean public good or happiness. This was understood in accordance with the principles of the Declaration of Independence. Such happiness is contingent on securing to each citizen his natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Because this requires the government be limited, the powers of the federal government were enumerated, and local matters were reserved to state authority. This was precisely intended to secure these inalienable rights and in turn promote the general welfare.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To receive a free pocket constitution and declaration, go to ConstitutionMinute.com.
We all have a common problem. How do you live well?
What is the right thing for government to do?
What makes a good children's story? It's what makes a good story.
Why is the serpent's punishment to crawl on its belly when that's what it does?
It took 65 million deaths to prove what should have been self-evident.
It's time to pull back and recall the big picture.
We were made to know the best things and to live in light of them. Let's begin.
Learn more about Hillsdale's online courses at hillsdale.edu.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Each week you can find links to the program on our Facebook page, via our Twitter account, or at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and everywhere else you find your audio. We're joined now by Lauren Scott. She's a junior currently at Hillsdale College, a history major and journalism minor, also a member of a class here that completed a documentary on a famous, or should be famous, Hillsdale alum. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Talking today about this documentary, Hillsdale Student American Hero, How Elizabeth Smith Friedman Beat the Mob and Won the War. Who was Elizabeth Smith Friedman?
She was a very prominent codebreaker in both of the World Wars. Also during the time of Prohibition, she helped bring down some of the most dangerous men in the world. And she was also, like you said, a 1915 Hillsdale alumna. She was involved in Collegian, the German Society, and a member of Pi Beta Phi while she was here at Hillsdale.
So why was a documentary warranted? Why spend an hour or so talking about the life of Elizabeth Smith Friedman?
I would say for two main reasons. The number one reason is because despite the fact that she is an American hero, and she should be studied in every textbook about American history, hardly anybody knows about her. And partially that's because of American FBI director at the time, J. Edgar Hoover, permanently erased her from history by having her name taken off of all of her decrypts and having them replaced with FBI identification numbers. Also because the work she was doing was very classified, top secret. She couldn't even tell her husband about the work she was doing for the Coast Guard and the Navy. It wasn't until 2008 that a lot of these records were declassified, and when he finally got to see who Elizabeth truly was. And then number two, she graduated from Hillsdale, but hardly anybody at Hillsdale knew who she was. And so it's really important to shine some light on what I believe is the greatest Hillsdale graduate, and to have the students and professors know about her life.
Let's take the two parts of the subtitle of the film and give us a little thumbnail sketch about what she did to, A, beat the mob. How did that happen?
During the time when organized crime was really big during Prohibition, the Coast Guard was in charge of stopping smugglers, and they were doing a very poor job of that, which was making them look bad. And so the Coast Guard showed up to Elizabeth's house in Washington, D.C., and they were actually looking for William originally. But when they found out that William wasn't available, they went to what they thought was the second best option, which was Elizabeth. They asked her to help them decipher these codes. And she agreed on one condition, that she would be able to work from home so she could still care for her children. And so she was probably one of the first stay-at-home moms in American history, which was really cool. She ended up putting three big smugglers in jail, and she even went against Al Capone at one point. Whenever she was testifying against Al Capone, Capone's defense attorney was trying to accuse her of witchcraft and basically making anything she said bogus. And she asked for a chalkboard and gave the entire courtroom a lesson on code breaking.
Lauren Scott is with us, part of a team of Hillsdale students who created a documentary about Elizabeth Smith Freedman, a 1915 graduate of Hillsdale College. So she beat the mob, and she won the war. How did she help win the war?
So her work in World War II, I think, was a little bit more involved than World War I. Her work in World War I was really important. I think the main thing she did there was she actually was training the first ever generation of code breakers. So there was no official code breaking unit in the United States until World War I, and she was the leader of that unit. But in World War II, I think that's when she had more of an immediate effect on the winning of the war. So one of the main things she did was, when World War II started, she switched from working with the Coast Guard to working with the Navy. Her main job was to decipher the enemy codes coming from the Atlantic, so she could keep track of where the German U-boats were in relation to the Allied ships. And this was really important because the U-boats were taking out a lot of the Allied ships, which carried supplies. Without her work, the supply line wouldn't have existed and would have pretty much knocked the British out of the war. And if the British wasn't in the war, then the war pretty much would have been over. And one of the biggest ships that she saved on the Atlantic was the Queen Mary. And so she was able to crack the enemy codes from the German U-boat to see that it was about to attack the Queen Mary, and was able to relay those messages to the captain so that he could then take the ship safe to port. And she saved about 8,000 men that day.
This documentary is available on YouTube if you search for Hillsdale Student American Hero. This documentary on Elizabeth Smith Freedman, done as part of a video documentary course here at Hillsdale. Lauren, tell us about the class and how this documentary came together.
The documentary class was amazing. I've said this before, if I could forget everything I learned so I could retake that class again, I would. But from very day one, like day one of class, we started working on this documentary. Our professor, Mr. Buddy Morehouse, he told us that we were going to be working on a documentary about Elizabeth Freedman. From that day on, we were assigned different jobs to do research. So at first, the research was more, not as heavy. So we started in the Hillsdale Archives. We started at the Mitchell Research Center. We asked professors if they knew about her. And we were able to find out a lot of what she was involved in by looking at a 1915 Hillsdale yearbook. We found out that she was in a Shakespeare play, A Midsummer's Night Dream, where she played one of the main characters, Puck. We found out that she was in the German Society. She was the literary editor for the Hillsdale Collegian. And she was also a member of Pi Beta Phi.
And I know you also did some traveling to conduct research in multiple locations, in fact. Where did you go, and what did you find?
So we had two students travel to Tucson, Arizona, to meet and interview the living grandson of Elizabeth Friedman. And that was a very neat opportunity because all the other research we did was pretty much about her work in the wars or during Prohibition, but this was an opportunity to know the personal life of Elizabeth and see who she was as a mother, as a wife, as a grandmother. And then we had four students travel to Washington, D.C. and Lexington, Virginia. In D.C., we were able to go to Arlington National Cemetery to see her grave. Now, she's only buried there because of William's service in the both of the World Wars, her husband William. And then we also went to one of the houses she lived in D.C. And this was the same house that the Coast Guard came and knocked on her door and asked her to do work for them. And then in Lexington, Virginia, that is home to the George C. Marshall Foundation, where the Friedmans donated pretty much everything before they died. So there were 22 boxes just filled with all sorts of things, copies of emails, Hillsdale essays and papers, drawings from their children. And so we spent all day looking through those boxes, and I think we maybe got through 5 or 6. Definitely didn't even put a dent into that. And so we got a lot of good information from that. We were able to see more of her perspective of what it was like to be a woman doing these great things, but then you're only ever known as William's wife. She wrote an article for The Arrow, which is a Pi-Fi publication. And so we're kind of able to see a little bit more of what it was like to be in her shoes. And then we also got to see a lot of her tests and essays from Hillsdale and read the professor's comments. And so that was really cool to relate to her as students and see that.
You can see it at YouTube. Hillsdale Student, American Hero, How Elizabeth Smith Friedman Beat the Mob and Won the War. Lauren Scott, junior here at Hillsdale College. History major, journalism minor, and part of this crew of students that made the documentary. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Paul Marino from Hillsdale's History Department, Steve Krakauer. His brand new book is Uncovered, and Lauren Smith telling us about the Hillsdale student-produced documentary on Elizabeth Smith Friedman. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at radiohour.hillsdale.edu or wherever you listen to podcasts. The assistant producer of the show is Nicholas Alfonso. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
James Madison writes in Federalist 51 that men are not angels. Their passions and self-interest often get the better of their reason and sense of justice. So we need government in order to protect our rights against those who would take them away. But for the same reason, Madison writes, government must be limited because people in government have passions and interests too. Many Americans today forget this. Supposing that we can do away with constitutional limits on government. Supposing that the unelected bureaucrats being put in charge of our health care, for example, will rule as if they are angels. If Madison was correct, however, it will become clear that they are humans, not angels. Learn more about the Constitution at ConstitutionMinute.com.
Hillsdale College, defending liberty since 1844.
We all have a common problem. How do you live well?
What is the right thing for government to do?
What makes a good children's story? It's what makes a good story.
Why is the serpent's punishment to crawl on its belly when that's what it does?
It took 65 million deaths to prove what should have been self-evident.
It's time to pull back and recall the big picture.
We were made to know the best things and to live in light of them. Let's begin.
Learn more about Hillsdale's online courses at hillsdale.edu.
Hi, I'm Elaine, a student at Hillsdale College. Here is Hillsdale College President Larry Arnn on the importance of the presidential oath of office.
Members of Congress and federal judges take an oath to the Constitution, but the Constitution prescribes the exact words of the oath only for the president. The American presidency was a new and powerful office created at the Constitutional Convention of 1787. Nothing like it existed in any other constitution in history. It was designed to allow certain virtues, decision, activity, secrecy, dispatch, things like that. And they were thought to be essential to executive power, especially in a crisis. But despite this immense power, the president is not so powerful as the Constitution itself. That is why presidents must pledge to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and why it is the duty of the people to ensure that they do so.
This Constitution Minute was brought to you by Hillsdale College. To join the national conversation on the Constitution, go to
When Black Bear Diner first opened, they filled the largest platters they could find. Not much has changed. Their legacy of huge portions continues today, and they've just introduced new diner deals.